Thank you, Jackie. First of all, I want to thank all the committee that put this together. I realize that these things take a tremendous amount of work. And my personal thanks, and I feel like I share your thanks also with those people. Let's hear it for the committee, huh? I put on one of these things for the West Texas Assembly once, and when it was done, I thought I was going to be a broken man. I'm so glad to see so many newcomers and young people here at this conference. Some of you I've got to talk to. Many of you have been kind enough to come up and speak to my wife and me, and we really appreciate that. It makes us feel right at home. You've even given us beautiful weather. We live in a little town called Nocona, Texas, and I can tell by the look on your face it's not a household word. People say, what's it near? It's not near anything. It's 2,992 people. It's always been 2,992. Whenever a new child's born, somebody leaves town. And you know, folks, we've had these tremendous rains. Perhaps you've read about them or seen them on TV. And when the sun finally came out and the water subsided in our little town, we found out that it had done over $20,000 worth of improvements. I know we're going to have a good time this afternoon. You know, these are joyous programs. My name is Bob Smith, and I'm an enthusiastic Alamon. There's four things that I think I must do to be an Al-Anon. I think I need to work the steps. I think I need to abide by the traditions. I think I need to attend meetings regularly. And I think I need to have a sponsor. And I do these four things. I have a sponsor that's one of those conference-approved Al-Anons. And my sponsor goaded me into service work. I've been the GR and the DR, and I put in 3 years as treasurer of the West Texas Assembly. And a few years ago, I got a letter from the home office of Al-Anon in New York City asking me if I would submit my name to be a candidate for trustee-at-large Al-Anon. And I prayed about that, and I seemed to have all the educational requirements that they were seeking. So I sent in my letter and said I'd be glad to be considered as a trustee. And guess what, folks? I didn't get it. Well, of course I was hurt. Wounded. But what I want to tell you is that my program came to my rescue, as it will in all facets of your life, if you'll let it. And I realized that this was the way it's supposed to be, that whoever took that job was infinitely better qualified than I, is doing a much better job than I was capable of doing, and I released it. It works. It just works. I've been in an Al-Anon a little over 11 years now. I came in here as a... Well, I owe it all to my wife, Betty. Betty drank my way into the organization. And really, folks, I'm truly grateful for that because it is showing me a way of living that I just wasn't smart enough to figure out myself. That's the way it was. Although I've only been Al-Anon a little over 11 years now, I'm somewhat of an anachronism in that I'm the only person still living that was present when the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the first time at the home of Henrietta Seiberling in Akron, Ohio on Mother's Day in 1935. And my father is Dr. Bob and my mother's Ann. And I rode out with my father and mother on that day. You see, my father had come home on the Saturday before Mother's Day with a potted plant. set it down. He was potted. He went on upstairs and went to bed as it was his custom. And Henrietta Seiberling was a friend of my mother's, and she called and said, "Ann, there's a man out here that thinks he can help Bob. Bring him right on out." Well, my mother had to explain to Henrietta that Bob was in no shape to see anybody. But being good Al-Anon material, she'd get him out there the next day. Well, he had a terrible hangover. And finally he said, "Okay, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want." But folks, when they got there, he and Bill went off in a room by themselves, and it wasn't 15 minutes. They stayed several hours. And as a result of that meeting, and at my mother's invitation, Bill came to live at our home there in Akron, Ohio, for all that summer, 3 months period of time. And this is the time and the place that Alcoholics Anonymous was first started. And I would like to take some of the time that you've allocated to me to tell you about the beginning of these movements. I think that they offer a hope. And I think that they have been guided by a higher power, a heavenly Father, to keep the thing from making terrible mistakes. I think little nudging miracles have kept it growing to what it is today. Now, it started in the middle of the last Great Depression in Akron. Was a one industry town. The rubber factories were all there. Goodyear, Goodrich, General, Firestone, Seiberling, Miller, and a bunch of others. Well, when people stopped buying automobiles, they stopped needing tires. And that town just fell flat on its face economically. There were strong men on the street corner selling apples for 5 cents a piece. There was repoed cars, just tier after tier, stored in the downtown garages. That's how tough the times were there. But maybe God provided that providentially because people had a lot of time on their hands. And they could be with each other. And I think that was so essential when this little movement was first starting. We lived in a very modest frame home there in Akron and would have lost that if it hadn't been for the mortgage moratorium declared by President Roosevelt in 1933, whereby people like us who could no longer make the mortgage payments were allowed to stay in the home and not be thrown out in the street. That's how tough it was, because alcoholism and the times had reduced us to a state of absolute poverty. There was times when there was nothing to eat in that house except bread and milk, sometimes nothing but potato soup. We didn't starve, but it was a near thing. So it was a really unlikely start. Well, Bill moved in, and I'd like to describe my father to you. I think you'd have loved the man. He was a tall, thin Vermonter. He had icy blue eyes. He was a graduate of Dartmouth, one of the Ivy League colleges in the East, and the Drinkers Ivy League College. And he had worked in industry a couple of years and then had come back to St. Johnsbury, Vermont, his home, and prevailed upon his father, who was a probate judge up there, to allow him to go to medical school. And he came out to Chicago and barely managed to graduate from medical school because his alcoholism, like alcoholism is progressive. And somehow managed to obtain a coveted internship there at City Hospital in Akron. It was coveted because they had some new equipment there. Moved out to Akron and married my mother after a whirlwind courtship of only 17 years. Dr. Bob thought things over very carefully. Dr. Bob had a brilliant mind, a great sense of humor. He was a man's man. As a young man, he used to like to go out in the woods in Maine and Vermont and sustain himself off the land. He liked that sort of thing. Women felt comfortable around him because he was always courteous. And he so obviously loved my mother that they felt at home with him. He loved the slang of the day, and I'm not talking about the nasty four-letter words, but just the words that the young people like to use. Even though he had a marvelous vocabulary, he loved that kind of words, so anybody could talk to Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob had been a general practitioner there in Akron for a number of years, and then he decided he would go back to Rochester, Minnesota, and study under the Mayo Brothers at Mayo Clinic, become a surgeon. Did nothing but surgery for the balance of his professional career. Well, Dr. Bob, like a lot of people I've noticed that drink, had tattoos. And, of course, they wore those short-sleeved surgical gowns, and one of Dr. Bob's was a dragon. And it started at his shoulder, and it went around and around and came clear out to his wrist, and it was blue with red fire. And I said, "Dad, how in the world did you get that?" And he said, "Boy, that was a dandy." He had a beautiful sense of humor. When I brought Betty home to be my prospective bride back in the 40s, he looked her over, and as you see, Betty's tall and thin. He got me aside and said, "She's built for speed and light housekeeping." And I'd like to tell you his sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. He got me up in the bathroom one day up on the second floor and closed the door, and I thought, "Hot dog, I'm going to find out all about it now." We sat down and he said to me, he said, "Fly spread disease, keep yours buttoned." I want to tell you some of today about my mother, Ann, who was so vital and so important to this early program. Mother didn't drink. She was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges in the East, and went there on a scholarship. She was no dummy. Her great uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad and took a liking to her as a young lady. And in those days, the president had their own private railroad cars, and they could tie onto any passenger train and go wherever railroads went. And he used to take her with him. And she got to know the gentle, nice part of life. She was had led a very protected life. She was a school teacher. She was very easily shocked until AA. Bill said himself, Ann Smith is the mother of AA, and I truly believe that because there was times when they were so discouraged that perhaps they might not have gone on, and perhaps none of us would be here. But she never lost faith that somehow this thing would work, that her husband would stay sober. Well, when Bill moved in, you know, Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter, and you'd have liked Bill, too, those of you who didn't get to know him. But he was the exact opposite of Dr. Bob. Bill was garrulous. Bill loved to talk. Bill was a promoter. Bill was a visionary. Bill Wilson could see further up the road than any human I've ever known. Bill's mood swung. He was either high as a Georgia pine or low as a snake. Yeah. He never seemed to level out. My father was the level one. And they fit together perfectly. And I think maybe God arranged that too, because, you know, folks, if any two of us are exactly alike, one of us is unnecessary. These two guys never had an argument. They seemed to fit together perfectly. And I think that was necessary too. You know, I've heard this said, perhaps you have too, that if AA had been left up to Dr. Bob Smith, it would still be in Ohio. And if AA had been left up to Bill Wilson, he'd have sold it to a franchise. You know, folks, we owe a tremendous debt to an organization called the Oxford Group. Bill had belonged to it for 6 months in New York, and my father and mother for 2.5 years there in Akron, and it didn't seem to have anything to do with Oxford, England. It was started out by a Lutheran minister by the name of Buckman from Pennsylvania, But the basic idea of the Oxford group was back to simple spiritualism. And they had some tenets that fit right into our program. We took them and we used them. They had four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity of thought, absolute love. Those things fit in. They also had a form of fifth step. I used to go to some of those Oxford group meetings with my parents, and I've often wondered why I went, but I did. See, I was a teenager when this thing started. And I guess I probably went because I was wanted to get out of the doghouse with my parents. You can't tell by looking at me, but I was not a constant source of joy to my parents. But they had a form of a fifth step also, and they used to take a new fellow upstairs in one of the bedrooms and bore in on him, four or five of them, till he fessed up what his problem was, you know. And they must have worked him over pretty good. I can still remember the guy coming down. He's pretty white-faced and shaking. But you see, that was a form of open confession. And, of course, that would not be satisfactory with people of the Catholic faith. And there are some Catholics who drink. I don't know whether you know that or not. Also, the Oxford group catered to the upper middle class. And believe you me, folks, the early drunks were not upper middle class. The Oxford group wanted publicity, and the alcoholics had already had all the publicity they wanted. So those things led to the fact that finally the alcoholics outnumbered the Oxford groupers, and they had to separate. They had to break away. But we owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude. And it was a difficult separation to make, but one that had to be done. Bill and Dr. Baum only had two things going for them that I know of. They had an open spiritual mind, and they had the desire for service. So the first thing they set out to find is another alcoholic. And they found a young guy by the name of Eddie R., who'd just been thrown out in the street for non-payment of rent, along with his cute little blonde wife and two kids. So they decided that they moved the whole shebang into our home, locked Eddie upstairs in the bedroom where he'd be available as they got this knowledge. You got to remember, folks, nothing's written. They're just staying a page ahead of Eddie. But Eddie was an agile guy, and we had downspouts, and Eddie would open the second story window, slide down the downspouts, and escape. And they'd have to postpone Eddie's treatment to recapture him. One time, Eddie got as far as Cleveland, Ohio, 35 miles away, called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide. But would give him time to drive up and witness the event. Can you imagine a more improbable start of anything? Well, they brought Eddie back, and when Eddie sobered up, he had a few little things that hadn't shown up immediately, and he began beating up on this little blonde wife. Then he began chasing my mother around the house with a butcher knife. So we held a group conscience meeting. And it was decided the only thing to do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, recommit him in a mental institution, and this was done. And, of course, Bill and Dr. Bob were crestfallen. Here's their first attempt to sober up another alcoholic together. Total failure. But I want to tell you folks something. At my father's funeral in 1950, 15 years later, a man walked up to me and he said, "Do you know me?" And I said, "Yeah, I know you. You're Eddie." And he said, "That's right." And he said, "I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year. And I tell you this because you never know the result of that 12-step call. You never know. We're only called on, I think, to make the call. I think the desire of the person that we called on, and our Heavenly Father will take care of the rest. But we are required to make that, and sometimes that's difficult. It's happened to me, and I assume it's happened to you. You make that call, and it's pretty obvious that the person you call on isn't even listening. And they don't, and it's obvious that they wished you weren't there. And pretty soon it's pretty obvious that you wished you weren't there. But when that happens, remember Eddie. Remember Eddie. You just don't know how long it takes. Maybe something you said will be retained by that person. You know, everybody was terribly broke, and hospital beds were very expensive then. A double room was $16 a day. I think they're up some now. But it didn't make any difference. Nobody had the 16 bucks. So what they decided to do was treat them in our home. Now, Dr. Bob's the only medical man associated with this fledgling movement at the time, so he'd take the fellow upstairs in one of the bedrooms, either my sister's or mine, and say, now, okay, now I'm going to give you a shot of whiskey, but I want you to take this little bit of medicine first. And it was formaldehyde. Yeah, some of you smelled formaldehyde. I can see a man nodding his head. Terribly pungent sedative. And so when Susie and I opened the door coming home from school, if we felt formaldehyde, we knew we'd lost our bed. But he knocked him out from 24 to 36 hours, gave him a tremendous jolt. And then when they came to, why, then he and Bill took them downstairs and they started on the diet, you know, to get the nerves settled and the strength back and the mind cleared up. And this is the diet. Canned tomatoes. Yes. Sauerkraut. Yeah, Bill had an ulcer and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And K-Ro syrup. Yeah. I think you all have to agree the early alcoholics were a hardy group. The early alcoholics were all low bottom. They were all men. Oh, just, well, kind of like this group I see right here in front of me. There was one lady that came along fairly early in the program, the name of Elsie, but they caught Elsie doing a little 13-step work on Dr. Bob's examining table with one of the early AAs by the name of Mitch. And, of course, the wives and sweethearts all went up in smoke, and they decided that perhaps they would better contain their efforts to the men for the time being. I think Elsie sent you gals calls back 2 years all by herself. But thank God you're here. Thank God you're here. This, you know, this thing was just a very trickle, very slow growth, until the media got a hold of it. You know, first an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, then Jack Alexander's article, and then as we saw it, the word got out that there was a doctor in Akron, Ohio, could, quote, fix drunks. And man, they came in on the bus, on the train, dropped off by loving relatives. Dropped off by relatives who weren't so loving. But again, I think our Heavenly Father provided the right person at the right time, the Sister Ignatia. Sister Ignatia was the admitting nurse in a Catholic hospital, and she and Dr. Bob prevailed upon Father Haas, who was the head honcho of that hospital, St. Thomas, to allow them to start a little alcoholic ward. And it was a flower room. I think some of you already know this. It's just seven cots. But anyway, for the first time, the alcoholic could be admitted with a disease of alcoholism, not under some guy's false admittance like gastroenteritis. It could actually be admitted with a disease of alcoholism. And you know, folks, that ward is still in that hospital. It's not the flower room. It occupies the whole fifth floor of the hospital. It has a private entrance to it. It's been in continuous operation ever since that time. My mother, I'd like to talk to this lady, about this lady to you. You know, she was the one, when they were taking these guys in, she made the beds, she cooked the food, she cleaned up the messes, she answered the telephone, and she did endured the snubs, because this program, these programs were not an instant success. It was thought of as a cult, a bunch of nuts, a bunch of overzealous zealots, and we were taking these people into our home, and we weren't very popular. You know, if you think that won't happen, just start a halfway house in your home, see how the neighbors react. The Presbyterian minister that we belonged to his church came down and personally kicked us out of the church. I never heard of anyone getting kicked out of the Presbyterian church, but we were. So you see, it wasn't an instant success, but she endured all that, and I have a letter here. She was the one that seemed to realize that it was a family disease right from the word go. And I want to excerpt this letter for you people. This was a letter written to Bill Wilson by Henrietta Dodson. Now, don't confuse her with Henrietta Sarling. Henrietta Dodson is the wife of the man that's considered to be the first successful AA, the Southern attorney in the stories. And I'll read this to you. On Friday, June 28, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I met Dr. Bob on Thursday morning in the hospital. On Thursday evening, when I went to the hospital to see my husband, Dr. Bob was there, and he said, "The little woman would like you to come over to the house." I told him I could not go that night, but would go the next night. On Friday night, when I went to the house on Ardmore Avenue, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I've ever known. After talking with her for a while, I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, "Ann, to you, my dear." She wanted to remove all the barriers. I skip a little bit. Bill Wilson was there at this time. And I skip a little more and said, "Ann told me to surrender myself to God and ask him if he had a plan for me to reveal it to me. Ann taught me to have a quiet time in the morning that I might feel near to God and receive strength for the day. She taught me to surrender my husband to God, not to try and tell him how to stay sober, as I'd tried that and failed. Ann taught me to love everyone. She said, ask yourself what is wrong with me today if I don't love you. She said, the love of God is trying her. It must flow from God through me, through you, and back to God. She taught me that I should never criticize the remarks of the person leading the meeting, as we do not know God's plan. Maybe what that person says will meet the need of someone in the group. In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a woman's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach us patience, love, and unselfishness. Ann made it very plain to me from the beginning that she wanted no credit for herself. It was God. All she wanted was to keep herself so that she could know and follow God's plan. When I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on AA, Henrietta Dodson." So you see, it was a family affair right from the beginning. And of course, Lois, while Bill was there, Lois caught the train and came out to see, visit with us, and see, I guess, if we passed muster. And that started a beautiful friendship there. And Lois could only stay a little while because she had to get back to New York City. Lois, you got to remember, was the only one that had a job. But when Lois decided to formalize our Al-Anon program, our beloved Lois, in 51, just prior to that, she sent out letters to all the AA groups around the country asking if there'd be any interest in this. And you know what she found out? She found out that 67 groups around the country had already figured it out for themselves, that it was a family disease. And they had their own little thing going. And 40 of those groups immediately came into Al-Anon. So there were a lot of thinking people around the country who realized that it not only affected the alcoholic, but it affected those who love the alcoholic and are around them. Betty and I attended the first international in 1950. My father was terminally ill. He was a dying man. And I want to tell you about this guy. You see, he only stayed alive and sober 15 years. He was older than Bill. And the last 5 years he was terminally ill. He was dying and he knew it. But in the length of time that he was able to and was active, this man treated AA and medically over 5,000 alcoholics without charge. And I think that I like to think of Dr. Bob as being Mr. 12 Step. And I've run it. But anyway, he was terribly ill, and after this first international, and this is the one where the traditions were adopted, and I want to tell you a little bit about that. You know, Bill had stumped the country trying to get the traditions adopted, and he wrote them in 46. But groups were then like they are now. They said, Bill, you go back and run that in New York. We'll do this like we want to. You know, they haven't changed. So it wasn't until he and Dr. Bob presented it to this First International that they adopted the 12 traditions, and thank God for that. The longer I'm in this organization, the more I realize the importance of those traditions. They're the glue that holds us together. They're the things that keep us from making mistakes that could have just blown it wide open. Betty and I took my father, drove him back to Vermont for the last time. And we shared some beautiful, poignant memories with that man, sitting on the edge of the bed at night and riding along in the automobile, things that we just wouldn't take for. And we drove him back to Akron, and I had a flying job out of Dallas at the time, so I had to get back to work, and I never saw my father alive again. But I cherished the memory that we had then. Betty and I attended the second one in 1955 in St. Louis. Bill invited us down there, and we got to hear the spiritual people who had been so helpful to our programs, you know, that weren't necessarily involved in alcohol, like Dr. Sam Shoemaker and Father Ed Dowling. And they recorded everything these two men said. And it's in the chapter Religion Looks at AA in the book AA Comes of Age. If any of you are interested, it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. Betty and I did not attend another one until New Orleans in 1980, and I met some of you people that are here today at that convention. You see, we were out working on our case history. AA was getting along great without us, and we thought we were getting along great without it. Occasionally someone would find out that Dr. Bob had a son, and I wasn't really advertising it because we liked to party and drink, you know, and do the things that young people, a lot of us did. And so we'd go to a meeting, and we'd enjoy it, and we'd get home, and we'd say, good for them. They needed that. Now, Betty put her father in a drying out place in Denver in 1944, and he and a fellow from California here, Bob D., who's still alive, started Alcoholics Anonymous in New Mexico in the 40s, in the early 40s. So, you know, if there was ever two people that knew about alcoholism, foreknowledge availed us absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's a shame to admit we were that stupid, but we got to do it. It's an honest program. It availed us absolutely nothing. I want to answer a question that I get asked pretty often. What's it like being raised in an alcoholic home? First 17 years of my life, I was raised in an alcoholic home. How many of you were with me? Would you raise your hand? Woo! There's a bunch of us. Well, you know, we learned to handle it in our own way. I was a runner. All you had to do was come by and honk the horn, and I left. And I didn't come back until I thought I could just barely get in without being in serious trouble. That was my way of handling it. I resented the poverty. I used to think when I was a kid in high school, if I could just have a quarter to have a milkshake with the other kids, wouldn't it be great? But that's how close we were. It just couldn't be done. And I resented that. But it isn't until I got into the Al-Anon program that I realized that many of us reach adulthood with some unresolved scars and some unresolved pain. Sure. Sure we do. But our program teaches us that's a plus, because we know that we've had some problems and we know that the solution's there. Now, I beg of you, don't get bogged down in the problems. Don't become part of the problems. Just, we know what the solutions are. And I want to say this to you personally. I do not intend to remain forever frozen in the role of an injured adolescent. So I've been privileged to see the despair in my father's and mother's home, and I got to see recovery, and believe you me, it was beautiful. You know, I love to see these guys come in the house with the blank eyes, you know, and sick, and then pretty soon you begin to see a little twinkle, and then here comes a viable, live human being. It's wonderful to see the recovery. Well, Betty and I went merrily our way, and despair entered our home again, our own home. And we didn't seem to know quite what to do. Well, Betty, I think, was the one that finally resolved it. The young man called her up and said, "We're starting a group here in Nocona for people who have a problem like you and me. Will you come?" And she said, "I wonder how he knew." Big secret, those two. But anyway, Betty went on to AA, and I got to see the change starting to make in this lady. She quit cold turkey, just hanging on by her fingernails, with not much help from me. I unintentionally obstructed her, really, because I was so untrained. I just didn't understand it, you know. Like, she started buying the groceries again, and I got a resentment. Yeah, and I hate to buy groceries. But she took off, and she just took off running with it. And the change was what attracted me. So someone said to me, "Well, why don't you join Al-Anon?" And I thought to myself, why not? I don't mind joining the auxiliary. So I got in my car and I drove over to Gainesville, Texas, 40 miles away, and I showed up at my first Al-Anon meeting. And I walk in there, noble. The rock that had been holding the family together. Bloody but unbowed. Just enough knowledge about alcoholism to be absolutely dangerous. And I look around and I'm the only man. Well, I began getting mixed emotions about Al-Anon immediately. And I think I can describe mixed emotions in a term that you'll readily understand. It's like that feeling you get when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 in the morning with a Gideon Bible under her arm. But thank God for those lovely ladies. They meant business. And they stayed with me, and they helped me. And you know, I carried around that image of that first meeting where I presented myself. I really laid a trip on those gals. You know, I was just almost perfect. Maybe a few little character defects. You know, I really worked them over pretty good, and I carried that idea around with me a long, long time. And it wasn't too awfully long ago I got to talking to Ann, one of the ladies that was there, at my first meeting, and I told her how I felt about it, and she said, "Yeah, and I want to tell you something. after you left, we had a little meeting ourselves, and we said, boy, there's a sickie. He ain't going to make it. Isn't it funny? The truth to us is how we perceive it. How we perceive it. Well, I didn't have any problem with God. You know, when you're raised in an alcoholic home, you get sent to church. You don't get taken, but I've been sent. And I was a bomber pilot in Africa in World War II. And I went from the newest co-pilot to the flight commander in the lead flight in 6 months' time because of the attrition we were suffering. And one night the squadron commander said, one of the pilots in your flight's having trouble. Ride with him. See if you can find out what his problem is and help him. And he said, I'll take your crew out. And we carried a 10-man crew in the old four-engine Liberators. And he took my crew out. All my buddies had been flying with me, and they never came back. I'm the only survivor of that crew. Well, I had kind of a panic button relationship with God, I guess you could describe it. You know, I wanted help, and God seemed to provide it. So that part of it, you know, believing, wasn't too difficult for me, like perhaps it has been to some of you. But the recovery has not been just the easiest thing in the world. I'd like to talk to you the balance of the time that I have about recovery, because I don't think, even though it's wonderful, it's not just all cloud nine. I think you'll agree. I used to think that our relationship had to be 50-50, right down the middle. Al-Anon taught me sometimes it's 90-10, sometimes it's 10-90, and what's the difference? What's the difference? That's just the way that it ought to be. Al-Anon has taught me that love is a learned phenomenon, and I used to think that I was a shallow person. I didn't seem to have that depth of love that some of you had. But I found out that you can learn it. And the first thing that you've got to do, in my opinion, to learn love is to accept it. My parents had offered me all the love, I guess, that any kid had ever wanted. But I would only accept so much, and then the barriers went down. Only allow them so close. So I hadn't got that knack of actually accepting it. And that's another thing that I've had to learn. And I think the more I accept, the more I have, so the more I can give to you. And when I give every bit of it that I have to you, I've still got every bit left. It's an amazing, amazing thing. Betty and I have four kids. And I'd like to pass this on to you. We had a pact. Whoever left first got the kids. That'll see you through some rough ones. You know, my father had taken my sister and I around to all the churches there in Akron, the different Protestant denominations, the Catholic Mass, the Jewish Synagogue, even took us by to hear the Bible as interpreted by Mary Baker Eddy, you know, the Christian Scientist that don't believe in doctors. But I think he wanted us to, if possible, keep an open spiritual mind. We had the Bible of the world with all the great Eastern religions in it, too. So he wanted us to keep our mind open. Now, let's talk a little bit of the things, of the little nudging miracles that I think God allowed to happen that, had they not happened, might have totally, totally wrecked the thing. And anonymity. What a beautiful thing that is. You know, in the early days, there were people with huge egos. Now, I know we don't have any of that anymore. But you can't be Mr. AA or Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is, right? And another thing it's done, it doesn't make any difference if you've been here 45 years or 45 minutes. We're all the same. Beautiful. Just beautiful. Money. A and Al-Anon don't have any money, don't want any money. Money, you know, Bill and Dr. Bob were human beings, and they thought, gee, what we need is some dough to really get this thing rolling. So they had picked out a big old graystone mansion there in Akron, and they were going to set up a treatment center. And Dr. Bob could see himself in his white coat greeting the patients at the door. Bill probably out on the street flagged them in, you know. So Bill went back to New York City to hit up the Rockefeller group for money. And Mr. Rockefeller and his group in their infinite wisdom said, no, money will ruin it. Miracle. Property. Al-Anon and AA don't own any property, don't want to own any property. We're not custodians of valuable real estate. We're here just for our primary purpose, and that's to take that hand that reaches out for help. Miracle. The big book of AA. This thing was written in the 30s. First published in 39. You couldn't give it away. There's only been one word changed in the first 164 pages in that length of time, from the original one to the one that we buy today. And that's the word spiritual awakening instead of spiritual experience. And they changed that because Bill was the only one that had experience right after that. But think of that book. How many texts do you have in your library that were written in 1939 without change that you use every day? It was written by people who weren't literary, somehow managed to plug all the loopholes. Just think of all the drunks that have tried to find a hole in that. Millions of them. And so far, it had to be a miracle. Written in some cases about things that hadn't even happened yet. And do you know that book is one of the five big bestsellers of all time now? Yeah. And you can't even buy it in a bookstore. God as we understood him. That was put in the 12 steps to quiet a loudmouth agnostic by the name of Jimmy B. from California. Jimmy said this God stuff will ruin it. It'll run them out faster than we can run them in. So to quiet Jimmy down, they put God as we understood him. And you know what that's done, folks? That has allowed these programs to go into religions that are entirely different from what you and I may have. You know, into the Eastern religions, into the Buddhist and the Hindu religions. Those words. Now, that had to be a little nudging miracle from God. Because that, just those words made it, make it acceptable to those people. Well, getting back to Betty and me, we finally had learned that healing love does not demand its own way. And we don't do it perfectly. Sometimes Betty gets on a dry drunk. Sometimes Bob gets on a dry dry. And if it happens at the same time, there's hell among the yearlings. But the point I'm making is that we both know enough about the programs now to realize that we're getting away from our program. And our program, the attraction, draws us back, and we get back into our regular routine. I heard, Betty and I did, we heard a lady, AA, say this, and gosh, it just knocked our socks off. She said, the person I was will drink again. And I thought, how true of us Al-Anons. The person I was will get sick again. I already know how to operate in that fashion. I spent years doing it. It's kind of natural with me. What I have to constantly work for is change. Just keep constantly changing so that I will not slide back and become the person I was and get sick once again. Our life has been a lot nicer since we've been in the program, of course. And I've met so many of you wonderful people, and so has Betty. We put carpeting in our bathroom the other day there in Ocona, Texas. And you know how good that feels on a cold winter morning. And we like it so well, we're thinking about running it onto the house. And, you know, I want to tell you this. I've noticed this, that AAs who have a good length of sobriety begin to show a little interest in our Al-Anon program. They quit making fun of us, and they begin to show a little interest. Yeah. Of course, the AA program is their primary program, but what I think interests and attracts them to us is that all the time we've dealt with living problems. Now they seem to have the alcoholism, you know, where it's manageable, but they still got the living problems. So they begin to show a little interest in our program. And I don't know if I speak for all of you Al-Anons, but this is sure true of me. I would like you to think that our programs are equal. Not the same, but equal. I don't like the idea that I ought to have to walk two steps behind you, AAs. And I know better than to walk two steps ahead of you because I'd rather turn around, you'd be gone. I want to talk to you a little bit about why I stay. I think that this is so important to me. I stay because I'm learning to be much more comfortable with myself like I am because of the program. I stay because I seem to be able to handle stress better. Not perfectly, but better. I stay because I am gaining in self-knowledge about myself and perhaps why I do such things and what to do and so forth. And I stay because this emotional turbulence that used to go through my mind, I had squirrel cage thinking. You know, I'd get a problem and it just round and round and round and round and never any solution. I'd do this for days. My program is teaching me how to get out of that sort of thinking. My program is teaching me how to be intimate with another human being. When I can let down my barriers and let you see me, warts and all, and you can do the same for me, you and I can have an intimate relationship with each other. And I don't know what that does for you, but I'll tell you what this does for me. It solves a problem that used to bug me the worst, loneliness. When I can be intimate with you people, I'm no longer lonely. Now, I differentiate between alone and lonely. I'm no longer lonely, and I think that's one of the things that bothers most people throughout life. But this program will teach me how to allow myself to be intimate with you and you with me. Well, I've enjoyed talking with you. Just love talking with you people, and I could go on a lot longer than you could stand, but you know, I think the only way to stay awake after a lunch like this is to be the speaker. But anyway, I've tried to talk to you a little bit about how my personal miracles have unfolded, that have gone from despair to the happiness that we share now, to the miracles that have happened in our life. And I'd like to address my closing remarks to some of you who perhaps are new in the program, that you have your doubts and your fears and you're wondering, it can't work for me because I'm different. And those things that naturally might be grinding through your mind that I could ground through all of ours. Well, folks, if you're in that category, talk to some of these other people. Every one of them here is a miracle of one kind or another. And they'd be tickled to death to talk to you. Open up and let them know. Because, you know, all of us here, except some of the new people, have seen the miracles. And if you're new and you're doubting and you're in despair and you think it's in such a mess, let me say this to you. You've got your miracle still coming. Don't quit before your miracle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.